Okay, good evening everyone. I'm broadcasting live October 17th, 2015. We continue with the Dhammapada. So we will now begin to record that. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 91, which reads as follows. Uyunjanti satimanto nanikete ramantite hangsava palalanghitva okamokang jahantite. Which means, Uyunjanti satimanto, the mindful exert themselves, or the mindful work hard. Nanikete ramantite, they don't delight in dwellings, in homes. Hangsava palalanghitva, just as a, or like a swan, having abandoned the lake, okamokang jahantite, they abandon house after house, home after home. So this story, this verse, was told in relation to a story that's actually interesting in relation to the verse. Because it actually implies something of the opposite, what you would think. From the sounds of this verse, you would think that the Buddha was saying that a person who is mindful, exerts themselves, such a person should, you would most likely expect to avoid having a home and wander, no? So here we have this story. The Buddha was going on pilgrimage, wandering, charika. It would be the Buddha would go around India to teach. So traveling from place to place and living and talking with people, debating sometimes with people, with other ascetics. Sometimes lay people would come and debate with him or ask him difficult questions. And he would teach and answer and spread his teachings throughout India. So he was getting ready to go, and all the monks knew that the Buddha was getting ready to go, and so they all prepared, packed up their things, they scrubbed out their bowls and gathered up their robes. And then they saw Mahakasapa, who was washing his robe. And they started snickering to themselves or you know, frowning, turning up their noses at this. Because this is a clear indication that Mahakasapa wasn't ready to go. And he wasn't going. And they said, oh, I know. One of them said, I know what's going on here. Here's a guy who is attached to houses. He's attached to his dwelling. I mean, who wouldn't be? He's famous and he's loved by all the lay people and they give him the best, choicest of food and robes and everything he wants, he gets here. If I got that, I wouldn't leave either. So no doubt he's staying here because he's attached to it and he's comfortable with it. Right? And so they gossiped and were rather fairly mean-spirited, it sounds like. Maybe not mean-spirited, but they certainly misrepresented his intention because the Buddha heard about it. Well, what happened then? Everyone left. All the monks left. And Mahakasapa went with them, but he got to a certain point and the Buddha turned and said to Mahakasapa, Mahakasapa, you stay behind. And the monks nodded and said to each other, now there you go, even the Buddha knows that Mahakasapa can't leave this place, he's too attached to it. And so when they were sitting down, I guess in the evening or They were talking amongst themselves when they were walking. Maybe the Buddha turned and said, "What are you guys talking about? What are you bhikkhus engaged in discussion about?" And they told him, and he said, "That's ridiculous. That's not at all." Well, he didn't use those words, but he said, "That's not at all why Mahakasapa was not ready to go, and that's not at all why I had asked him to turn around." Because Mahakasapa made a determination in his past lives to be a support for lay people. And so he gives a long story about when he made this determination, but for our purposes it's not really useful. The point is he had this intention to stay and be of benefit to people. If all the monks left, then who would stay to teach and who would stay to care for and encourage and really support the meditators and the practitioners in the area? So Mahakasapa knew that it was his. He and the Buddha were actually very close. And when the Buddha passed away, Mahakasapa was sort of looked upon as the leader of sorts, though not to take the place of the Buddha, but to take over some of the role of guidance and of direction. So when the Buddha left to go on his tour, Mahakasapa he knew it was best for him to stay behind, because otherwise there would be many things that left undone and many people looking to learn about the Dhamma who wouldn't get to hear it, and so on. And the Buddha said, he told this long story about, he told a story anyway about Mahakasapa making this wish to be of benefit to people and to not go out of his way. And then the Buddha said that he pointed out, using this verse, he actually pointed out that it's not that it's not that people who are mindful, who are enlightened, and like an arahant, it's not that they are the ones, or they are not the ones who need to leave houses. Right? They will need to leave their dwellings, need to be careful, because they have no attachment. A person who has no attachment has no problem staying behind. It's the exact person that you want to have stay in one place and teach and to spread the teachings. So it kind of put the other monks in the place, because the implication is, well, all of you guys have to come with me so I can take care of you and so you can not be attached to one place for too long. And so in Thailand you get this a lot. Monks will wander and never spend more than one night or never spend more than one week in one place. I've talked to monks who spent the whole year outside of the rains. They wouldn't spend two nights in a row in the same spot. So they would constantly be moving. It's harder to do now, but there are monks who do this. I'm not convinced that it's the greatest thing to do, but there's a sense that, well, when you're still when you're still attached to dwellings, that can be quite useful to keep you on your toes. So this is our story. And the verse, which is fairly clear, but let's just go through it. So Satimanto Uyunjanti, that the mindful are not lazy, is basically what's being said here, because there was an implication that Mahakasapa was lazy. He just couldn't be bothered to go on a tour. Why bother when everything is so comfortable here? The Buddha pointed out that even when mindful people stay in one spot, you can't call them lazy. They will never get lazy because they're mindful. A person who stays put, even a person who does nothing but walk and sit all day, shouldn't be considered lazy. Their mindfulness keeps them alert, keeps them energetic, keeps them from being lazy. So it's not necessarily the case that just because you stay in one place, you're not going to be energetic. The mindful are always energetic, never lazy. So those of you who feel like you're lazy out there, use mindfulness. You don't have to go running or you don't have to exert yourself, just be mindful. When you're mindful, you can be sitting still all day and still be considered energetic. Your mind will be alert, then you won't fall into the trap of being lazy. Nanikete ramantite. They don't they don't have love for dwellings. So it's not that they leave them behind, that they have to escape them, but that they have no love for them, and they will leave, and they're happy to go when it's time to go. So the second part says, like a swan leaves behind a lake, the swan doesn't worry about the lake. The swan is not concerned with the lake or say, oh, that was a nice place, maybe I should stay. Swans, when they leave, they leave. I mean, swans are just dumb animals, but in the same vein, the swan not worrying about the lake or not loving the lake or falling in love with the lake or being attached to it, the swan goes and knows when it's time to go. In the same way, wise people or those who are mindful, oka mogang jahantite, they leave behind or they abandon house after house. So basically saying, Mahakasapa has no problem leaving. He certainly is not attached to. I mean, Mahakasapa was one of the greatest of the Buddha's disciples. There's some traditions that say he's still alive, waiting to give his robe to the next Buddha. He entombed himself in the mountain and went into a trance, and he's going to stay there for whatever thousands or hundreds of thousands of years before Maitreya comes. And when Maitreya comes, he's going to come out and give him his robe. I think it's a Mahayana tradition that says, or it's maybe just an Indian folklore or something. But he's highly revered. As he was, apparently the tradition is, I think, that he aspired once to be a Buddha. But when he met our Buddha, he realized, oh, how difficult it would be and how much better off he would be to learn from this Buddha. So he put aside his intention. Or maybe that was Mahakachayana, I think. That's a different monk. I'm confusing them. But no, Mahakasapa was the head of the Sangha after the Buddha passed away, or the father of the Sangha is often called after the Buddha passed away. It's not exactly accurate, but that's sort of how he's looked upon. So he was a great figure in the Sangha and certainly had no attachments. But there's a couple of lessons we can learn here. The first is not to criticize people. Really not at all. You know, criticizing others rarely does any good. It usually just feeds your ego and helps assuage any insecurities we have. You know, you feel better bringing other people down a notch. Not good. And it's often misguided, you know. People do things for reasons that, if we thought about it, we might be able to empathize and understand why they're doing things. You know, the person who you're very angry at because of the evil things they've done, well, who knows why they're doing them? Probably they have evil inside of them. But they may be doing it because they feel hurt or because they're in a position where they're not able to understand what's wrong with what they're doing or this kind of thing. And often they're doing it blamelessly. You know, and we get to constantly, Ajahn Tong, people would criticize him and about the silliest of things. There was one monk who came and saw that Ajahn Tong had all this wonderful food because people, they adore him. So the food that they would give him is special, extra special food. And there was this one Western guy who ordained as a monk for a short time, and he just was disgusted by it. He said, what's he doing eating all that good food when we have to? I mean, I think it came from the fact that he wanted some of the good food, but he just felt it was wrong and unfair. People criticize things. Like, there's this story of this Zen story of these Western men, I guess, who became monks, and they went to live with this Japanese monk, I think Japanese monk, Chinese monk maybe, and probably Chinese. And they were in the monastery, and every day, in the monastery, every day the monk would bow down to this Buddha statue. And so the guy started doing it, and then every day we had to do bowing and bowing and bowing to this Buddha statue. And finally the guy got upset about it, and he turns to him and he said, "Look, this is ridiculous. I don't want to bow down to this dumb statue." And he said, "I'd rather spit on that image than bow down to it." And the Chinese monk turns to him and says, "Okay, you spit, I'll bow." Maybe sometimes we hold on to things quite strongly and we miss the fact that it's not wrong what the other person, what other people are doing, you know, they have reasons for it. And we have to ask ourselves, that's what I learned a lot in Thailand, because I was that sort of way in Thailand, criticizing this, criticizing that. But then I watched and I saw, especially Ajahn Tong, how uncritical he is and how accepting and how he just doesn't even comment on so many things. And then he, when he does comment, he finds the good in it. He finds a way to focus people's attention on what's good about it and to point out that, sure, he'll say sometimes, like, you know, some people say this is just a ritual, but, you know, it makes people feel good, it makes people mindful, it makes people think about the Buddha, etc., etc. And that really opened my eyes to, yeah, that's it. I mean, we're the ones with the unwholesome mind. This guy who was obsessed with spitting, well, he was the one obsessed with the bowing. He was the one that got upset about it. That's the first thing we can learn, is to not criticize others without knowing their reasons. No? Be careful. We should always worry more about our own faults. Nat pare sang vilomani, nat pare sang katagatang. We shouldn't worry about the faults of others or the things they've done or left undone. The second thing is this point that I've sort of already made, that, but it's a two-pronged point. There's the idea that people who are truly mindful don't need to do any special practice. And that's very much true. You know, a mindful person, there's this Zen thing about the Buddha riding in a Ferrari and wearing gold rings and so on, because he wasn't attached to it. And so this kind of thing, you know, it's possible to go way too far with this idea. Because you say, well, okay, so a mindful person doesn't have to do any special practice. A mindful person doesn't attach to things. Well, then they could have sex and they could drink alcohol and they could do drugs and all these sorts of things. It wouldn't hurt them. But the point is that mindful person wouldn't do these things. I mean, it's not to say that it couldn't happen. You can be raped or that kind of thing, but and you can drink something thinking it's not alcohol and wind up being alcohol or drugs or so on. I was once given these pills by this woman. I don't know what her deal was, but I don't really think she had bad intentions, but she gave me these pills saying it was like ginseng. I thought, well, ginseng, that's good for your mind. But when I looked it up on the internet, I took the pill and I swallowed it. She gave me this bottle and she said, it'd be good for you as a monk. And so I took the pill, I swallowed it, and as it was settling in my stomach, I looked on the internet to see what its characteristics were, and it was an aphrodisiac. Like, oh, well, there it is. I guess that's the only one I'll be eating of that. But it's true that, you know, if you don't have the desires, then it shouldn't affect you. You know, it shouldn't be a problem. But people use it as an excuse to do things that they want to do and claim that they're not attached. Yeah, I enjoy it, but I'm not attached to it, right? It's a huge exercise in delusion, in self-delusion, that somehow you can be angry and not cling to it, or be greedy and not cling to it. It's certainly not the case. Anything that's mental, any of your mental judgments, that's what where the problem lies. Anything that makes you afraid or worried or bored or sad. Angry or greed or anger in its very base forms, they are in of themselves a problem. So you shouldn't use this as an excuse to stay put. In fact, often Mahakasapa may have stayed where he was, but he in the end went and lived up on the hill, on the mountain above Rajagaha. I think after the Buddha passed away, yeah, that's where he was staying, because that's where they did the first council. And they invited him down. They wanted him to come and stay in the city because he was the big monk and he was getting old. And they said, you know, we need you down here to stay, support us. And he refused. Every day he would go back up, walk all the way up. It's quite a walk. Every day he would walk up and live up on the mountain. Apparently he never laid down either. He would always walking and sitting, never lying down throughout his life, or his later years anyway, but I think throughout his monastic life. So yeah, don't take, so it's not like he was just living in the lap of luxury and not clinging to it. He was, and they asked him why, and he said it was out of compassion for others so that they will be able to see the good example. And because it's much more peaceful. It's just the right thing to do, living in the forest, living alone, living at peace. There's no sense of that. But one should not be attached to these things nor criticize someone. I mean, a lot of criticism, there was this big criticism that went around recently about these monks who had their own private jet and wore sunglasses. And at first I understood that that was the criticism, and it didn't really faze me at all. I'm like, okay, well, it's possible that the monastery could have a jet for, you know, it's a bit outrageous. But my point being, those things in and of themselves don't necessarily, because they're tools. You know, even sunglasses, lots of monks wear sunglasses. Ajahn Tong wears sunglasses. Why? Because he had eye surgery and the light is, or has been, or was, his eyes were very sensitive to sunlight. And, you know, I know lots of monks in Thailand who wear sunglasses. I don't really think it's that great of an idea, but it's not in and of itself a sign of huge corruption. I mean, there are far worse things that can and probably do go on that we're not really aware of, but you'd be careful not to judge. Not to judge things by appearances or etc. I think it turns out that those monks were selling drugs or doing drugs or this or had women or this or that. So, yeah, that's something you can definitely criticize them about. But it's an interesting quote. I mean, it's on the face, it's a sign of the importance of not clinging to. Our place, our possessions, not clinging, to be mindful. But deeper down, and if you know the backstory, it has more to do with the idea that you don't need to be too concerned about going off into the forest. Oh, how can I follow the Buddha's teaching living in the home life? Yeah, it's more difficult. Yeah, you're going to be tested and tried, but it can be done. And we should be clear about two things. One, that it can be done. And two, that unless we're really, really mindful, it's much easier to get attached. So you have to be more on your guard, more vigilant when you're living in lay society, when you're living in a house. You know. Much easier to be mindful. It's actually kind of cheating. It's easier. It's an easier way to go off in the forest, where we think, oh, going off in the forest, that's difficult. It's not really difficult. Living in the forest, there's nothing. It's just simple and easy, and it's wonderful. Anyway, so that's the Dhammapada for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Wishing you all good practice and that you all become free from suffering. Be well. Okay. So we're trying something a little new now. Robin and I are now both outputting to the audio stream. We should be. So maybe someone can let me know if Robin's volume is loud enough, because it should be. It should now be a lot louder and a lot clearer than it was before for those of you listening to the audio stream. So, questions?
We have questions. The first one is an Android app question. I have Android Lollipop on a Samsung Galaxy S5. Sounds enabled, a chime chosen in settings, test sound works, but still no chime between meditations nor after. Suggestions?
Which one's Lollipop?
One after, let's see. H-I-J-K-L. After Kiwi?
I don't know what that means. I know numbers. Kit Kat what? Was 5, right? No, Kit Kat was 4. J-K-L is still 4 point something, I think. You know, update to number 5, I guess, is Android 5.
Yeah, it's the S5.
No, it's not. Android 5. Android 5 would be... Meringue, was it? What was the next one?
Well, mine is ice cream sandwich, and it's 4.0, I think. So,
ice cream sandwich is 4.0. A-I-K.
It's 4.0.
Okay. No, I wouldn't be 4, would it?
Let me check.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, right, because then they went 4.1, 4.2, that kind of thing. I don't know, sorry. I'm not the expert here. We need some Android developer to come and help us out.
Yeah, 4.04 is ice cream sandwich, or at least one of them. So, Does stilling the mind completely only come when we do samatha, or will vipassana make our minds also more still?
Also more still, but completely doesn't come from either samatha or vipassana. The complete stilling is from... Complete stilling is from nibbana. It's the only way you get completely stilled.
My mother tongue is Persian, and I saw that the translation of your book, How to Meditate in Persian, is in progress, and I was wondering if I could help with this.
Yeah, Ali said he was going to translate it, and I don't think he ever got around to doing it. I can put you in touch with Ali Ishtari, and so if you send me a message, I can get you in touch with him, and you should bug him about it. You know, just ask him if he's finished, if he needs some help. Probably he'll let you take it over, but I think he's still the one who was doing it. There may have been someone else. I mean, there's been so many people, I can't remember. He may have said he couldn't find time to do it, and then someone else said they were going to do it and still didn't do it. So, absolutely, if you really think you can get it done, let's put you in charge of it. We have to get in touch with people like Ali and figure out whether he's still doing it, but... Let's do that. It'd be great to get a Persian translation.
Oh, sorry. One thing, we have different meditators who are asking, you know, what sort of projects you need done. Would it be helpful to have one person who communicated with all of the people that are in progress on the translations and kind of coordinated that, got a status update on those?
Sure.
Okay. So if somebody was...
We could put a page up on the site. No, we have a page, but we could add to the meditation page. Where is that? It's on the main site, so someone could just add, or we could make a different page that has people's names on it and what they're working on.
Yeah, so maybe I'll bring that up at the volunteer meeting tomorrow if somebody's interested in reaching out to all the different people that are in progress. And
so yeah, tomorrow's our volunteer meeting if anybody wants to come.
Yes. What was the first past life of the Buddha?
First of all, that's a very speculative question. Second of all, that's a very speculative question. I don't think we're all that interested in that, sorry.
I can't figure out what the first past life means, but I'm tired today. But what does that mean? His first life or his life prior to enlightenment?
Yeah, if you mean the one right before this one, I can tell you about that. Although actually I can't, because he was up in heaven and they don't really talk about that period. Yeah, he was in heaven before he was here.
But in general, if someone was very interested in, are the Jataka stories, are they all past lives of the Buddha?
Yeah, 547.
So if you're interested, there you go.
It's a bunch. But that's not even a drop in the ocean.
Bhante, although I realize that one must never get lazy in meditating, what are some foolproof ways in which one can determine whether one has attained second path? Thank you.
Be a Buddha, probably. I don't think there's much other way. A Buddha can tell you. Otherwise, it's very difficult to discern exactly.
Jamie said 4.4.4 is Kit Kat. I don't know why I thought it was Kiwi. It's been a long day. Are there commentaries available for the Sutta Pitaka, and where can I find them?
There are. They're all online. You can go to suttacentral.net, I think. I think they have them. You can also go to tipitaka.org. But there's nothing in English. Oh, there's very little in English. So you're going to have to learn Pali. But the commentaries, a lot of the commentaries can only be read in Pali, because they're etymologies and, you know, plays on word. It's harder to translate the commentaries into English. Which is why the Visuddhimagga translation is just so awesome, because he really did a good job trying to translate a commentary.
And Tina says the audio feed is a little louder than before, but both of our voices have static noise when talking on the audio feed.
Mm. Let's take a listen.
I wonder if that's just when it's live, or if it's also on the recorded version.
A lot louder and a lot clearer than it was before, for those of you listening to the audio stream. Oh, there's some real static. It's like a clicking or something. So, questions?
We have questions. The first one is an Android app question. I have Android Lollipop on a Samsung Galaxy S5. Sounds enabled, a chime chosen in settings, test sound works, but still no chime between meditations nor after. Suggestions?
Okay, so it didn't really work as it should have. Which one's Lollipop? It's quite behind, actually. It's about 30 seconds behind.
After.
At least, maybe more.
Let's see. HIJKL. After that, that's the same. Oh, that's right. It used to not be quite as delayed as the regular YouTube.
Yeah, used to be a lot quicker.
Is there something one can do when bad conditions are going on, or should we just accept them?
You can be mindful of them. That's the best place to start, because then anything you do is going to be informed by mindfulness. It's not going to be based on your likes and dislikes, your emotions, your partiality. It's not going to be irrational.
This just reminds me, Guadalupe had a good question a while back, and I think I overlooked it maybe, but it was a question about if my ideas are discriminated against frequently, is that part of my karma?
Sorry, I was to say again, I was reading something.
If you feel that if you believe your ideas are being discriminated against, people don't accept your ideas, put down your ideas, Is that part of your karma that that would happen?
No, it's their karma. I mean, it could be based on your karma. If you've done things to them in the past, they might be discriminate, you said, or discounting your...
I believe it's discriminating.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of discrimination. It could be because of things you've done. But usually it's part that and part other people, their new karma that they're creating. Because they have a choice. They don't have to be mean and nasty to you.
In the comment that turning on the phone's notification settings fixed the no chime problem between walk and sit. Yeah, that would definitely be somewhere to start checking the settings. Isn't it required that something permanent exists which can observe the impermanence of phenomena?
Yeah, I can understand where you're coming from with that, but no, it's not exactly how it happens. What we know is that a phenomenon arises, and then in the next moment there is a recognition of the phenomenon. Basically, I mean, it's a bit more complicated, but that's basically it. The recognition arises and ceases, but we know that somehow it arises because of the earlier experience. But the experience arises and ceases, and the next recognition of it arises and ceases, and there's other, you know, many, many different things that arise and cease. But no, the observation of impermanence, is really just the mind that comes after a mind that had a concept of permanence, concept that there was something lasting from moment to moment. That mind comes first, and then there arises a mind that is free from that. So impermanence is actually a negative. It's not that you see impermanence, which, you're right, would require you to see one mind to see two moments and say, oh, look, that ceased. But instead, it's the giving up of the idea of permanence, because you see, you realize that things are just momentary, that things are only one moment. You realize how things are. It's a experience of one moment after the other. It's an interesting question.
My concentration is strong sometimes and weak other times, but when concentration is strong, there's an ongoing train of thought that I am ignoring while I meditate, but noting thinking or knowing if it gets too distracting. Is this correct practice?
You should never know, you should never ignore it. So if there is an ongoing train of thought, you shouldn't ignore it. Is when you're aware of it, you should say thinking. When you're walking, maybe we can, but even if it's a train, you should stop. If it's a stray thought in walking, we sort of say, well, just, you know, bring your mind back to the foot. But a train of thought should be noted. There's no reason to stay with the stomach when there's something else going on.
We're caught up on questions.
Okay.
Wait. I guess I have a question.
Okay.
So you did some chanting today.
Did.
Is that going to be a regular thing, or?
Well, I don't know if we'll do it broadcast, but I'm gonna try to do it every day. Yeah. But
that's nice.
Just thought tonight we'd broadcast it. I guess I did think, yeah, maybe we'll do this every night broadcast, but then I sort of thought, it's not really all that useful. We're just gonna wind up with 1,000 YouTube videos, not 1,000, but tens and tens of YouTube videos with the same thing.
So
it keeps them all.
Do you do the same chanting every night?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that was the thing, is we could instead chant a sutta, and then I could explain it. But you know, one teaching a night, it's already enough.
Oh, definitely. If you just had a handful of people could use them, though, to they could just use it themselves to chant along with it, as a practice if they wanted to.
Yeah.
contemplation of the three marks of existence be scary?
Sure. Yeah, it turns people off of meditation sometimes. They think something's wrong. They think, what's this practice? This isn't what I signed up for. I wanted something stable, satisfying, and controllable. What are you doing showing me all this impermanent suffering and non-self? It's horrible, really. It's not at all what people want to see. It'd be great if things were otherwise. If reality were pleasant and satisfying and controllable. Okay, enough. Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you, Bhante.
Bye.
Good night.